say that there is not one member of the House of Commons who observes the speed limit. I venture to say that as legislators, we are not entitled to enforce and to continue speed limits.
And you can hear lots more from Tessa Dunlop and myself by subscribing to the Where Politics Meets History podcast on Global Player and the LBC app. Coming up in the next hour, it's Tuesday's Cross Question. I'm joined on the panel by Lucy Fraser, former Conservative Culture Secretary, David Aronovich, journalist and broadcaster, Emma Sinclair, tech entrepreneur, who's the Chief Executive of Enterprise Alumni, and Ollie Dagmore, Editor-in-Chief of the news and entertainment website joe.co.uk. They are here to answer all of your questions. The number to call 0345 6060 973. You can WhatsApp us on that number, text 84850, and of course you can watch us on Global Player and the LBC app.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 8 o'clock, detectives believe the car that drove into crowds at Liverpool Football Club's parade yesterday had followed an ambulance through a roadblock. Merseyside police say 11 people remain in hospital. They've been given extra time to question a man on suspicion of attempted murder and drug driving. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, has been visiting Liverpool and has praised the emergency services.
The professionalism of their response, the way in which they worked together to make sure that lives were saved and to be able to keep people safe, I think is hugely important, and we really thank them for that.
A van driver has been jailed for 12 years after running down a three-year-old girl who was visiting Manchester with her parents. A court heard how 36-year-old Raoul Roman had taken at least 20 lines of cocaine before it happened in February. The King's warned Canada is facing a critical moment as he spoke at the opening of the country's parliament. The remarks come after Donald Trump's threatened to make Canada part of the United States. Adidas says customers' personal information has been stolen in a cyber attack. The sportswear giant has apologised, but says passwords and credit card data were not compromised. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed up 60 points at 87.78. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.19. LBC weather, rain clearing eastwards to leave a mostly dry night. Showers lingering in central areas, a low of 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Daryl Jackson.
This is LBC. From Global, leading Britain's conversation. Cross Question with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good evening and welcome to Tuesday's Cross Question here on LBC. On my panel tonight, David Aronovich, journalist and broadcaster, Lucy Fraser, former Conservative Culture Secretary, Emma Sinclair, tech entrepreneur, and she's the Chief Executive of Enterprise Alumni, and Ollie Dagmore, Editor-in-Chief of the news and entertainment website joe.co.uk. They're here to answer all of your questions, whatever they may be. We have a very broad church here, so you can frankly ask something. Well, I'm hesitate to say whatever you like, but you know what I mean, within reason. And you can also watch us on Global Player and the LBC app.
Call 0345 6060 973. Tweet at LBC. Text 84850. Cross Question with Ian Dale. This is LBC.
Right, let's do our first text question with James in Hitchin. He is asking, does the panel support the apparent new precedent when it comes to high-profile incidents of violence that the police feel obliged to inform the public about the alleged assailant's demographics within a matter of hours? It's obviously referring to the Liverpool incident last night where the police described the man as a 53-year-old white male. Now, when they said that, I must admit, I did think to myself, now, why are they doing this? And I instantly thought, well, it must be to do with the Southport attacks. At that point, we didn't know what the reason was behind the attacks, and they were obviously keen to point out that it was a white British male that perpetrated this horrible act. Lucy Fraser.
I think they did the right thing in this case. I think they did the wrong thing in the Southport case. And I think communication is really important. And I think being honest and factual is important. So I think they did the right thing to identify the facts and I think that, I mean, I know there's a lot of controversy about it and the difference and why did they feel the need to do it. But I do think that in this instance, they got it right.
But they've now created a precedent, haven't they? If, say something similar happened next week, let's hope it doesn't, but say something similar happened and it was somebody who's Asian or black or Chinese, do you think that they would almost then be duty bound to say that as well?
No,
that,
I don't. I don't think so. I think that
so it should only be said when somebody's white.
No, I think that in many cases you should consider matters on a case by case basis, and I think it was the right thing to do in this case. In another case, it might be the wrong thing. And I think that they shouldn't feel duty-bound to do a particular thing. They will, of course, be exposing themselves to criticism if they don't do it. And I'm sure there'll be a furore, whatever they do, in some sense. But I don't think that they should be bound to follow the precedent that they've set.
David Aronovich.
Yeah, I mean, it has the effect of meaning that people don't stand outside mosques trying to burn them down or trying to burn asylum seekers out because they immediately don't have. I suppose they could go to over to West Derby where the suspect is from and start burning down a few pubs. And if that were to happen, then I imagine people would feel that, that was an indiscretion on the part of the police. And Lucy is absolutely right. This is done for this reason, and you won't do it under every circumstance that's imaginable. Unless I don't think you will, but there will be a demand. I think the idea, however, that this will stop people spreading misinformation is unfortunately untrue, because we have a significant proportion of people online who are dedicated to the proposition that no matter what happens, they will use it to fit in to their preconception about what has happened. But in the case of cars being driven into crowds, which has become a terrorist tactic in many places over the course of usually lone wolf types of terrorism, over the course of the what, last 10 years, when was that big Nice lorry? That was about 10 years ago, wasn't it?
Since then.
I think it's not surprising that they wanted to make absolutely clear that the suspect wasn't fitting any profile that anybody could kind of get really intemperate about.
Ollie Dugmore.
Well, it's set up probably pretty clear evidence of a potential two-tier policing system, right? If every time that there's a very serious incident, it's perpetrated by a white person, the police are very quick to say, don't worry, guys, it's been conducted by a white person, so let's definitely not do any race rioting as a result of this one. And then if the perpetrator does happen to be from a certain religious background or another minority group, we withhold that information. What does that say about our society? We're essentially saying that the general public can't be trusted or are liable to outbursts of civil unrest if they find out certain information about perpetrators. And I think that's an incredibly worrying and dangerous place to be. Look, for what it's worth, I think it's actually probably a good idea by the police. For years now, there's been this yawning gap in terms of information and the distribution of information between traditional legacy media outlets, whether it's broadcast, newspapers, anywhere, and social media, where an event like this will happen. And very quickly, you can watch in HD video what's happened. Before the police were put out this statement and said that, you know, the suspect is 53 years old, white, British, I'd seen a video with the car door open. I'd seen that the suspect was white. And I think it's for the betterment that the police are trying to move with the times and, you know, exist within that information economy. But we can't ignore what I think is quite an obvious signpost about the state that our country's in and sort of where racial tension is, that we're genuinely saying, if someone's white, yeah, okay, we'll come out and we'll say it and that'll calm people down. What relatively soon there is going to be a moment where a police chief is going to have to make a decision and say, okay, our suspect is a young Muslim man, possibly let's make it sort of the most politically charged option available, young Muslim man who's crossed on a small boat, are we going to go public with this information? What's the appropriate thing to do? And I do not envy the person that has to make that decision.
And there is no right or wrong answer to that, is there?
No, I don't think there is.
Because whichever way that police officer went, there would be consequences.
Oh, massively. Yeah, you open yourself immediately up to the two-tier criticism, which obviously has ginormous play with the far right of politics in this country at the moment. Or, okay, let's say we go out with the information, are we going to kick off in another bout of civil unrest as a result of doing it? It's an absolute sort of political minefield now for police chiefs, which is a situation I know they absolutely would not want to be in.
Emma Sinclair.
Short and sweet. I remember reading it and thinking it was really odd that they'd mentioned that it was a white person, and I'm not sure how it helped anything at all, and would tend to agree with what you just said. Very odd.
Well, I suppose it helped in the sense that we didn't have a repeat of the scenes in Southport.
There's so many demographics that are at risk or targets, or I just can't see that it's a healthy direction of travel. Personally, it didn't resonate, and I balked when I saw it in the headlines and thought, how odd.
I was listening to the radio and it really struck me that it was being repeated over and over again. It's a white British man. And I was sort of thinking, I should know, I've worked in journalism, and I was thinking, has there been an instance where the police have been this quick to identify the ethnic background of an offender before? And I couldn't think of one. I'm sure there'll be more veteran crime reporters who possibly have more of a view on that than I do.
They normally do it when someone's charged, don't they?
Yeah.
They did say he was 53, which means that you could, I suppose, kind of set about 50-year-olds in the population.
We should emphasise also, just for legal reasons, he's only a suspect.
He's only a suspect, absolutely.
I'm a bit worried now because I am just turned 53.
Never.
Yes.
Did I say that quickly enough?
I'm surprised by it as well. But to go back to it, it's precisely because nobody will go and burn down a pub in liveable West Derby that this is done. I mean, so when you're talking, Ollie, about the statement it makes about society, that statement has already been made. That statement was made last August when people did that. And it is remarkable to me that there are still people who are getting incredibly angry about people going to prison because they were involved in those riots, those subsequent riots. I mean, just imagine for a moment that there were a whole group of angry black people, Asians, Jewish people, whatever, minorities, who did decide to take it out on the white population because this person was white. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, I think there's a real insight here into sort of the tenor of national politics, media discourse, and the actual context of what is happening within society at large, because you're absolutely right. We're not a year away from widespread race rioting in this country. There is a very, very divisive and, again, emotionally charged conflict in the Middle East, which is leading to hundreds of thousands of people marching through the streets of London and confronting each other there. And all the while, we kind of have this, I would say, quite calm, certainly not high-flying rhetoric from Keir Starmer that I don't think matches the actual conditions that the majority of people are existing in society. And I think there's a real risk, and there are certain, I'm sure we're going to talk about this, other political parties who are making great hay of this, but there's a real disassociative effect of, let's say, a political figure says to you, fastest growing economy in the G7, we're turning the ship, and you're going, hang on a second, My real terms wages haven't increased for 10 years. This is I'm struggling to make ends meet. It has never been harder, but you're telling me all of this is okay. Okay, how about I start to consider more fringe political opinions? How about I start to consider the more extreme politics? Because actually, what you're saying to me and the conditions you're describing do not match with my experience of reality.
You've kind of just answered the next two questions that are coming.
You're
always a man ahead of your time. let's take this one from Scott in West Hampstead. Is Nigel Farage the new political champion of the working class, or is he a populist wolf in sheep's clothing who's prepared to do or say absolutely anything to get people to vote for reform?
I wonder what the questioner thinks.
I think we can probably tell, can't we?
He has a view.
Well, David, let's start with you.
One of the things I find very interesting is whenever people talk about the working class, because there is this kind of claim about the working class, Labour doesn't represent the working class anymore. And I was brought up in this Marxist background, and my dad was incredibly keen, he was a communist. When you said something like the working class, he forced you to define what you meant by it. Did you mean the proletariat? What did you mean? So I just looked up on the way in. In 1979, I think it was, there were 13.2 million trade union members in Britain. There are now 6.2. The working classes, as defined back then by social class, were about 50% of the population. Now they're about 20-25% of the population. So when we talk about the working class, we're not really talking about the working class in the way in which people kind of conceive of it. We're talking about something different. Does he represent... And actually, Ollie kind of touched on it slightly, people who are really angry about their kind of situation one way or another, or angry about the country, or enjoy identifying with people who are angry about the country as opposed to people who are more phlegmatic about it. The latest polling shows that Nigel Farage is still the least popular choice for Prime Minister when matched up against virtually any other Prime Minister. Unfortunately, I don't think they match it up against the co-leader of the Greens, so we can't discover that kind of improbable match and so on. So, yes, he is. He's a populist opportunist who articulates pretty well how a lot of people are feeling in this country. It's not a majority of people by any manner of means. And he's pretty talented about it. I think the one thing you have to notice about, and this is going to be very interesting, and I'll bring my remarks to a close imminently, is like the kind of, you know, new reform leadership of Lincolnshire Council, a flood threatened county. They've just managed to abolish their flood committee for some kind of reason. Nigel Farage has never run anything, ever.
Nor's a business minister, so it doesn't really disqualify him.
I can't remember who the business.
Jonathan Reynolds.
Has Jonathan Reynolds never run anything?
No, he did a year in a law firm. No, he's never run anything.
Okay, so
nice man.
You don't have to be a teacher to run the Department of Education.
I think you have to have some understanding of business if you want to be responsible for business personally. Sorry to have interrupted, but
I always genuflect before business leaders about questions of business. It's the only time I do it. No, I'll do it in front of farmers on farming issues. They do know about silage, and I don't.
Emma?
As best I can tell, Farage is telling people what they want to hear. None of his sums seem to add up. But as best I can tell, also, Starmer seems to have isolated everybody that originally voted for him. Interestingly, this weekend I was away with a bunch of lawyers and relatively high-earning business people who were all saying that they were considering voting for reform, which I found pretty staggering. But then again, I found it staggering that entrepreneurs and business leaders were voting for the Labour Party. So what do I know?
Ollie?
Is Nigel Farage the voice of the working class? I think as David touched on, we already have kind of a bit of a mechanism for that, which is if you wanted to try and identify working class people in this country, you could probably look at the trade unions that represent people that work, I don't know, the clean trains or our teachers or our nurses, okay? And those same trade unions have democratic institutions, they have elected officials, and at the very top of those, you have their chief secretaries, people like recently Mick Lynch, Eddie Dempsey, and you can kind of say with some seriousness, okay, well, they actually have a bit of a democratic mandate, so maybe that is the voice of the working class, although I don't think anyone really should be saying I speak on behalf of this section of society. Is Nigel Farage of 10K a year Dulwich College a voice of the working class? Is Nigel Farage, former metals trader, a voice of the working class? Is Nigel Farage the leader of a political party that until very recently was just an incorporated business and had none of those mechanisms of internal democracy a voice of the working class? Bankrolled, in fact, by several billionaires, one of whom is the deputy leader, I think he's a millionaire, not quite a billionaire, Richard Tice, and says that property portfolios, a property business is steeped in his family's blood. Is that a voice of the working class? I would hesitate to say no, but also I would say in the question, you know, are the two things mutually exclusive? Just because you're a populist, does that mean you can't be the voice for working people?
Lucy Fraser, what he's doing is tapping into people in society, many of whom would describe themselves as working class, who voted for Boris Johnson, voted for your party in 2019, got thoroughly annoyed with the antics over the next few years, and now have become rather annoyed with Keir Starmer as well. So where do they think of going? They don't necessarily look to the Liberal Democrats, which they would have done 20 or 30 years ago. They're looking at Nigel Farage because he's saying, well, I'm the logical choice. They've let you down. I haven't let you down yet.
Yes, he's definitely tapping into something. And I think the British people have an innate sense of fairness, and people think it's not fair that they work hard and other people are claiming benefits. They think it's not fair that they work hard and immigrants are coming over here getting benefits and taking their jobs. And I think that many of those people and many others feel that nobody is representing them at all. And I don't think this is a new phenomenon, actually. I think they have felt this for a long time. They felt this for decades. So if you actually look at the statistics for how Labour have done, how this demographic have voted historically over the last few decades, they haven't been voting Labour for some time. So in 2010, the Labour government got more votes from the professional and junior managerial groups, the ABC2, ABC1s as they're known, and less votes from C2s, Ds and Es, skilled and unskilled workers. In 2019, the Conservatives got 48% of C2 Ds, so skilled and unskilled workers, while Labour got 33%. So these people have been moving away from a party that they don't think has represented them for some time. But the question, the real question is, are they going to go to Nigel Farage? And I think the jury's still out of that.
Well, they're not going to the Conservatives, are they?
Well, I think
maybe if there's some young blood that comes along, because I do think
They did vote Conservative in 2019, and I think that Nigel Farage is. I mean, today I listened to what he said, and he made a whole load of unfunded commitments. And I think the British people are much cleverer than we give them credit for sometimes. And I think that they will see, unless Nigel Farage actually puts policy and figures behind what he's saying and the rhetoric, I'm not necessarily convinced that they will vote for him.
My partner, who's not particularly into politics, but sort of will listen to a few programmes, was watching, because I had it on this morning on Sky, and I watched him while he was watching Nigel Farage, and I was thinking, he's actually taking this in. And I said, what do you make of that then? And he said, well, it all sounds complete common sense to me.
It does.
And
it
I'm
does.
Thinking, well, if he's representative of people who aren't as obsessed by politics as people around this table are, then, I mean, he's exactly the kind of person that Farage is.
Nigel Farage is a brilliant politician. I mean, he has done phenomenally well, and he's, to his credit, reform is doing well because of him. But do you think that when we get to an election, which is 4 years away, people will start asking questions? For instance, how much does this policy cost where you're not going to be charging tax unless you earn £20,000? And the answer is it costs around £60 to £80 billion. And I think that's quite a simple fact that might get through to people as time progresses.
Will they? Because, I mean, I just think to myself, on the one hand, we all remember that the Tories, you know, didn't really work out, and then Labour didn't really work out. And as you say, I mean, sometimes I listen to Farage, who I don't support, but I'm like, I see where you're coming from, and I see how this can resonate with a lot of people.
Right, we're going to move on. I'm tempted to ask you to answer this question from Andrew. Please ask the panel to name a reform cabinet. I could do with a good laugh, says Andrew. Sadly, we have to go to a break. It's 21 minutes past eight.
This is LBC.
Protect your dog from fleas and ticks with new Front Pro chewable tablets. Easy to give, each tablet offers 1 month's protection, helping to keep your dog happy, healthy and close. Because nothing should come between you. Front Pro chewable tablets from the makers of Frontline. Available online or in-store from pet specialist retailers. For more information, see uk.frontline.com. Contains a Foxolana.
Hey, it's Roman here. Now at Vodafone, you can get the epic Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra and save up to £1,008 when you trade in an eligible phone. Plus, you can experience the exclusive Circle to Search feature, available only on Android, helping you to search fast and find what you need without switching apps. Go online or in-store today. Ends 12th of June. Vodafone.
Save £576 on 5GB airtime over 36 months and £72 on the phone. 100MB max speed, eligibility, credit and trade-in checks and terms apply. Finance Vodafone.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Got any tips for the football?
Your best bet is to head over to BetVictor. They're giving new customers a terrific welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they'll give you £30 in free bets.
Phew, that's a steal of a deal.
It's a good darn deal that'll make you squeal for real. Neil?
My name's not Neil.
I know, but it rhymes.
Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the football at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in and bet on any football marketing at odds of evens or greater. No cash out, 7-day expiry. Terms and conditions apply at gamblerware.org.
Cross Question with Ian Dale on LBC.
23 minutes past 8 on LBC. We have with us in the studio former Conservative Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser, David Aronovich, journalist and broadcaster, Emma Sinclair, who is the Chief Executive of Enterprise Alumni, and Ollie Dugmore, Editor-in-Chief of the news and entertainment website joe.co.uk. Karen is in Leeds. She wants to know, why is the government seemingly waiting till the autumn to scrap the two-child benefit cap?
Now, the government's Child Poverty Task Force has now been delayed from this spring until the autumn, with the Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson hinting this morning that it will indeed choose to scrap the two-child cap on benefits, which was first introduced by the Conservatives in 2017. Ollie Dugmore.
I think they'd probably say fiscal rules, I would imagine, would be the Labour Party answer. I think anyone with a little bit more political savvy would say you've shut the door after the horse has bolted. Nigel Farage today in that speech saying that reform will scrap the two-child benefit cap, as well as actually, I think perhaps the most interesting thing was quite shortly after that, he then said he would want creches in major corporation, major workplaces. So if you find yourself as the Labour Party sort of sat in 10 Downing Street, or number 11 actually in the case of Rachel Reeves, and you look to your left and Nigel Farage is over there, you sort of have to ask yourself a question. And if the answer is, oh, maybe we'll do something about that in 6 months. I mean, they have got a lot of time because...
It's what they've done on the winter fuel allowance.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, it feels listless, doesn't it? It feels like a political project without an idea. It feels like a political project without much strategy behind it. And I think this is what they're going to fall foul of, to be honest with you.
Emma?
Perhaps a lot of bad news is coming later this year, so perhaps it's a little bit of good news for some demographics. I'm not looking forward to what number 11 will be saying later this year, so that's what I reckon.
What do you mean by that? What do you think is going to happen?
More tax. Not such great outcomes as number 11 would have you believe about the economy and about the work they're doing, so I'm not terribly hopeful about what we're going to be hearing from Labour Party later, so perhaps that's just something to keep certain demographics from getting angry with them, because I will be.
Lucy?
Yes, they can't do it at the moment because they don't have the money. It's going to cost about £2.5 billion. But they've been forced into this position because of the decision that they took this week to do a U-turn on the winter fuel payments. So it's inevitable that it's going to happen. But as Emma said, they're going to have to decide how to fund it and how to fund the winter fuel payment at the same time. And I do fear that means further tax rises.
David?
They got quite a good report card from the IMF today, actually, saying that growth wasn't going to be too bad. They were lifting them and saying that they were, by and large, following the right trade policies and so on. And if they followed up on their planning policies, then that should lift growth. So they got a nice little growth forecast. But the caveat was, but don't mess around too much with your fiscal rules and so on, because actually that could ditch things. So What's happening? We know this. Rachel Reeves has been walking on a tightrope since the beginning of the Labour administration. I mean, I think Lucy, in her most candid moments, would have to agree that this government inherited a crock when it came to the economy. We all knew it before the election even happened. It was kind of characterised by 2 years of short-termism by the Conservative Party, by the administration, which left them in... helped to leave the situation in everybody in trouble. And to add to that, we now have the Trump trade tariffs, which will probably depress the world economy to a certain extent over what it was before. So it is a really kind of tricky position. So they will have, presumably to do this, they will have to find money from something else. Now, I'm less worried about taxation, higher taxation, if I know who it's going to. I mean, with respect to your friends in business and so on, I do remember sitting next to a whole lot of people at a Times CEO meeting, this is where David Cameron had just been Prime Minister, and they were saying, oh, you know, tax is terrible. And I said, well, don't you have enough money? And I might just as well have farted the biggest fart that you can possibly imagine. You couldn't imagine a kind of more out-of-place question. They never asked me back to the Times CEO.
So
the CEOs didn't want me again. They didn't want to be asked that kind of question.
It's in a week and a half you could slip in with me.
Well, I think David's hit on the point there, right? Which is, why is tax a dirty word? Why, when we say, oh, they've got to find the money from somewhere? Well, you know, Strategic Defence Review, Starmer Magic's $13 billion out of a hat to deal with the sort of increasingly fragile and dangerous world that we find ourselves living in. When their political motivation is there, we can find the money. And if we go, do you know what? It's going to cost £2.5 billion, but it will lift 500,000 children out of absolute poverty. And by the way, sort of specialists in this area are pretty unanimous in saying that if there was such a thing as a lever you could pull to take children out of poverty, the two-child benefit cap would be one of those levers. Torsten Bell, actually, until he joined the Labour government, was quite keen on changing this measure, and I suspect he still thinks it's a mechanism that you could change, just can't say it now because he's got the government whip. Why is tax a dirty word? Why not raise it? These things
well,
are political
it's
choices.
Because it's the highest ever level, that's why, and people don't feel they're getting value for money.
Only because the economy hasn't been growing. When you think about corporation tax, we don't need to have a very long political memory to go back to 80-90%. I'm not saying that's where we should be now, but certainly you could look at increasing taxes on the highest earners. You could look at reforming inheritance tax. You could look at changing council tax to a land value tax. There are myriad options available.
The highest earners are already leaving the country. And I know people on the left always say, oh, no, they're not. Well, the evidence is there for all to see.
What patriots? Oh, an extra, let's say, 1% or 2% in your taxes every year. Do you know what? That's enough. I'm leaving. First of all, I do challenge the assumption,
you know. It's not 1% or 2%.
Well, no, sorry, I'm saying if you raise their taxes by 1% or 2% and you go, do you know what, that's enough for me, I'm going to leave the country. See you later. You know, I genuinely think paying tax...
That doesn't help the economy.
Paying tax in this country... first of all, I think there has been research into capital flight and whether or not it happens when taxes are increased or decreased, and it's certainly a contested area.
But you don't need research. It's happening at the moment. I can't... At the moment, I'm no longer in politics, so I'm talking to businesses day in, day out, and it doesn't really matter who I speak to. Whatever, there might be professional services companies or they might be estate agents. Everybody tells me that their clients are leaving the country. They are entrepreneurs who are building this economy, who are giving people jobs. The Laffer curve is real. People are happy to pay a certain level of tax. Mm. And of course, people should pay tax to help the people who are most disadvantaged. But what we know is when taxes are too high, people either stop paying them because they leave the country or they find ways to avoid them. And that isn't helping the people on the lowest pay at all.
So we put
and hire people overseas.
Our hands up and say, do you know what, these people are avoiding taxes. Oh, what a shame. You know, we can do things about this. Oh, what, they're relocating to tax havens. Do we want those people to be contributing to society? Are they meaningful? You know, we're talking about entrepreneurs in these really glowing terms. What powerful conviction, what honourable, upright, standing citizens they are.
Let's not pick just the entrepreneurs. You sound
I like entrepreneurs. I think it's brilliant. I think there's nothing better than someone who decides to build a business, build a life and contribute to this country. I think it's a wonderful, brilliant thing to do.
But when it gets too expensive to hire people here...
Well, how expensive are we talking? You know, is the argument that we are genuinely on the precipice of the Laffer curve? That if we change personal taxation by 1% or 2%, these people are going to leave in droves? Is that what we're saying?
You don't seem to be open to the idea that people are already leaving, so I'm not sure.
Hold on. Let's be careful here. Only a few people are leaving. They just happen to be a particular. I mean, there are some paradoxes here which we should note. Firstly, if you are very wealthy, your tax management is usually incredibly good. And you can minimise, and you can do an awful lot to kind of minimise your tax situation. The second thing is that the thing that I was told mostly within the last couple of years by experts were that what businesses wanted were good investment situations and a degree of certainty about the forward investment situation. So what I don't understand is why they are so much more bothered about their own personal taxation than they would be about investment certainty. I don't really believe it. So I can believe that there are some gazillionaires or millionaires who are leaving the country. It may be that it'll cause you some problems in some places at some times, let's say the London property market being an example, although would it really be an absolutely terrible thing for us if there was a reduction in price of London properties and so on? I can't tell you. I mean, I need, you know, it needs to be discussed. But what I don't really think we can afford to do is have people say, because taxation goes up by 2p in the pound or whatever, then in that case we're going to lose all the entrepreneurs and all the businesses, no matter what else is going on in the economy. I find that hard to believe, honestly, because this country is still a really good place to be. It doesn't stop being a good place to be because somebody's bunged your tax up by 2p.
I might add that I can't speak for the gazillionaires because I don't know any, and I'm definitely not one. But I can speak for small and medium-sized business owners, CEOs, myself, and people aren't hiring. And that can be if I'm sitting at a Time CEO summit opposite somebody that runs a big public company with 10 to 20,000 people. And it's in the world of scale-ups I inhabit, where our businesses are sort of 5 to 50 million, where people are not hiring here. And it's not because they're mean or, don't want to spend an extra penny or two. Because, by the way, I love being in the office. I'm old-fashioned. I believe in coming in. And I love the people that I've got in my team here. But when it becomes untenable in a growing business, business in a challenging economy, and you need five people, and you can only afford two if you buy them, if you hire them here, but it's five if it's in Brazil or the USA or South Africa, you have to say to yourself, I will need to build a business, and I've only got so much money.
But that's not a tax question, is it?
No, but what I'm saying is there were two parts to this. It was a question about tax, and it was a question about kind of, you know, earners and how tax and how the government impact businesses. And so one might be to your personal side, which you took great exception to, and the second part is hiring people, because people need jobs and people aren't able to give them to them at the moment.
It sounds like a very challenging environment, but I would say it's morally challenging to me that Rishi Sunak's effective tax rate is less than someone who's earning 50 grand a year PAYE.
On that bombshell, we're going to go to the news. It's 8:34. Here's Daryl Jackson.
Detectives in Liverpool have been given extra time to question a man on suspicion of attempted murder and drunk driving. It's after a car drove into pedestrians during last night's Premier League trophy parade, injuring 65 people. It's believed the car got through roadblocks by following an ambulance. A man's been charged with the attempted murder of a police officer in Buckinghamshire. PC Christopher Miller is in hospital with life-threatening injuries after a crash while on duty in Stoke Poges on Thursday. And the King says a relationship between Canada and the US rooted in mutual respect can deliver transformational benefits for both countries. Charles is only the second monarch to give an address at the state opening of Canada's Parliament. LBC weather, rain clearing eastwards to leave a mostly dry night. Showers lingering in central areas and a low of 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity, we actually reward you for it. That's why, when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
It's your home, darling. Let's make it fabulous. High scoring isn't my forte, but there's no arguing with Trustpilot ratings. Shotterly Fabulous have an expert team of fitters who specialise in one thing, simply gorgeous window shutters. Made to measure, hand-finished and expertly installed. Make your home Shutterly Fabulous. So don't diver, darling. Book a free consultation with our expert shutter fitters today.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Leading Britain's conversation. Cross Question with Ian Dale. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Lots of people liking our panel tonight, and quite right too. Lucy Fraser is here from the Conservatives. We can still describe you as a Conservative, can't we?
Yes, Ian, you can.
Because some people who leave politics, sort of, they become very independent. But
Some people stay in politics and are very independent.
Well, that is very true. David Aronovich, journalist and broadcaster, Emma Sinclair, chief executive of Enterprise Alumni, and Ollie Dugmore from joe.co.uk. Quick 30-second elevator pitch for joe.co.uk. UK.
We're a social media publisher. We create content about sport, entertainment, politics, and I think in a world where increasingly people talk about young men, because that's primarily who our audience is, and say, you know, where are the role models? Where are the people that are trying to explain the world to these young guys? They're just listening to Andrew Tate. They're just listening to Sneeko. They're just listening to take your pick of a toxic influencer. The stage, the boxing ring has not been vacated completely.
No, there's Ian and me. Isn't there?
Yeah, we're too old. Well,
yeah. Why?
Well, we just.
I don't even know who Sneeko is. Does that make me old?
Yeah, sort of a birds of a feather, shall we say, in that toxic male.
So basically,
space.
It's lads.
Yeah, well, there's a very significant proportion of our audience, 40% in fact, who are women. But 40%. You know, you sort of play this game where you're sort of trying to tell people what you do, and by segmenting your audience, eventually it just becomes kind of reductive,
apparently,
right?
The Women's Hour program on Radio 4, 40% of its listeners are men.
No.
So all these programmers, they have these great ideas about program for particular niches, and it doesn't really work like
that. Ian, I tell you, every time I I come on another broadcast and I say, yeah, we're a social media publisher broadly aimed at young men, and my postbag gets filled up with recently
ladies
retired women emailing me saying, this is the first time I've been called a young man in my life.
Right, let's go to Chris in Stubbington. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Ian and panel. A couple in Hampshire have won £1,000 after footballs from a neighbouring school's sports pitch entered their garden. Are people becoming less tolerant of children?
Now, Mohammed and Marie Anne Bakati were awarded £1,000 in damages by the High Court because of the nuisance of footballs being kicked into the garden of their £2 million house in Winchester from the neighbouring school at a rate of one ball every other day. First world problems, ladies and gentlemen.
English problems.
David.
This is such an English story.
Is it?
Absolutely it is.
I bet the same thing would happen in Switzerland.
The couple who took the local church to court because of they were ringing the bells. And people said to them, but you chose to buy a house next to the church. That's what they do. They ring the bells. You want a house next to the school, they kick the footballs over. And so on. So if you didn't like it, why didn't you buy a house somewhere else? But no, those are two. That's one thing. The other thing is the £1 million house thing. This is the kind of absolute kind of Daily
Two
Mail.
£2 million.
£2 million. Yes. The Daily Mail thought bubble. You can't talk about anybody's house without putting the price on it.
Who is the only campanologist on this panel?
Do you? Know
what you? I don't ring bells.
Me.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
You're good.
Not anymore. I used to do it. I was made to do it when I was in school. Hated it.
Yeah, but with handbells.
No, proper plain Bob Major and all that.
If you held on to it, would you go?
Yes.
Wow.
Even I would go. Lucy.
I've done it once, but I don't think that...
Bell ringing or kicking balls
into the garden. Anyway, back to footballs in the garden.
Back to footballs in the garden. I'm really pleased when people kick footballs into our garden. It makes us, you know, bond with the neighbours. I think it's quite...
Are you mad?
I think it's hard to comment on a particular case because you don't know what else has gone on in that case that's made them so cross. So there might be other things, but...
Prize orchids damage or something. Yeah.
But I do agree with David that this isn't the sort of thing that should be going through our courts, which are quite full.
I have a lot of my neighbours' cats come in the garden, so I'm currently scheming about how I can fund the next phase of my business growth from suing my neighbours for cats. Not really, because I've got four and two dogs, but I do have a lot of things that come into my garden.
I can give you some advice. Don't pick them up and put them in a bin in front of a CCTV camera. That's my advice.
Thank you for that.
No, this is one of the most famous YouTube videos ever produced.
I've seen it.
Oh, no, I'm a trustee of a cat rescue charity, so there's no risk of that.
Ollie.
Look, I pity the chap from the council that had to go and stand and observe their garden and figure out that it was one every other day that was being knocked over, because that's a tough assignment.
Is it a well-paid job?
Yeah. Don't tell Reform, they'll be cutting that bloke's job before you know it. Lucy, you said something really interesting, right, about a moment of social connection with your neighbours, and this for me is really revealing about sort of the direction that our society is heading in, where people are becoming so atomised and isolated, that the idea that, you know, a football being knocked into your back garden and being encumbered with having to return it over the fence. I mean, I'm sure they don't even probably return it personally. They probably just toe poke it back over the fence, one would imagine. It reminds me, I did a piece in 2019. I went to a place called Grassmoor where there's a working men's club, and the bloke was running it. He was in his 60s, and he was telling me when he was 17 years old, on the verge of his 18th birthday, he couldn't wait to turn 18. So that he could go to the club for the first time, because it was a bingo hall, 250 seats, it was jiving, it was moving, and it was the first time he was going to go in there and he was going to have his legal pint, and that was the place to be socially. It was the only thing he could think of. He runs the place now, the lights never get turned on in the bingo hall, it's empty. And he just very directly said to me, people have got their Tesco beer, they socialise on Facebook, and maybe they'll play a bit of PlayStation, and they don't come out anymore. And
Smile, the nightclub is a shout.
Yeah, it was more than 6 years ago, and it still stays with me, because I think it's such a damning indictment of where our society is heading, that rather than engage with each other in the real world, we would rather post about it in
Ollie,
the local Facebook group.
Ollie, you are, before the end of the programme, going to have to tell us what you like about
something
way society is going.
I'm going to throw myself
I think we're now on our third damning indictment.
Yeah, this is interesting, isn't it?
Also, because, just so you know, even though the nightclubs are closing, and I'm really sorry to hear about that club, and I would come to bingo with you if you wanted to. There is a massive resurgence in silent discos in museums around the country, which I know doesn't really in theory involve conversation, but you are singing 80s music with thousands of people you don't know.
That sounds like a good night out to me.
It's brilliant.
Maybe we'll do that. Look, I it would be remiss from me because, you know, notwithstanding whether or not certain people on the panel are 53 or not in relation to our earlier conversation, there is a slight generational gap between all of us here, and I wonder if that maybe informs my perspective on our society versus how some of you guys see it.
Are you saying I'm old?
No, absolutely not. I couldn't believe you're 53. I couldn't believe you're 53, Lisa.
We all knew how to have a good time.
I know how to have a good time, Ian. Don't you worry about that.
I don't know. You're very upset about a lot of things. I'm going to worry about you when we leave here tonight.
Yeah,
in a motherly sort of way.
Look, no, I'm not old. Stop it.
I'm not sure if the other people that are sat next to me in the pub are having a good time, but I certainly am.
Apparently, the reason why nightclubs are closing, and in fact, grassroots music venues are closing and pubs are struggling, is people aren't drinking anymore.
Yep.
So the younger generation aren't drinking, so there's no revenue coming into
massively.
These places.
Yeah, more sober, less sex, less drugs, less smoking. It's kind of across the board.
Oh
yeah.
Can we
no
say
wonder
less
he's angry.
Sex, fewer
yes.
drugs? Can you get the grammar right, please?
Apologies, Ian.
Honestly. He runs a website and can't speak properly.
I'm not the sub-editor.
I think we're going to go to a really serious subject next. So we've got about 2 minutes to compose ourselves. It's 8:45.
This is LBC.
Body pain might not sound like this.
Oh.
Or this.
Oh.
But it might sound like this.
I'm fine.
Hiding your body pain behind a smile? Let us help. With up to 12 hours of uninterrupted muscle and joint pain relief. Voltarol, the joy of movement. Voltarol Joint and Back Pain Relief 2.3% gel contains diclofenac diethylammonium. Always read the label.
How likely is she to, you know, have another heart attack?
Can I still go to the gym after heart surgery?
Is my mum still my mum if she has a new heart?
When it comes to heart health, no question is too big or small. That's why British Heart Foundation have dedicated cardiac nurses you can speak to by phone, email, or online chat.
Hi, this is Chloe from British Heart Foundation. How can I help?
Search BHF Cardiac Nurses.
Tired of watching your uninvested cash do nothing? With the Bank of England base rate reducing investment platform, IG is doing something extraordinary. IG is offering a whopping 8.5% AER variable on all uninvested cash. Yes, 8.5%. Just open an account, transfer money in, and make one investment before May 31st to unlock this incredible rate. Visit ig.com now to open an investment account today. Your capital is at risk. GIA, ISA and SIP accounts only. Boosted rate applies until 31st August 2025. Terms and conditions apply.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Here's Alex, turning at a junction. Alex cooks a mean Jalfrezi. And here's Sue, waiting to cross the road, off to get a takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
Sue's a curry fan, but she can't cook for toffee. Alex, let's give way to Sue. Because pedestrians crossing or waiting to cross have priority at junctions, whether they can cook or not. Whoever you meet, travel like you know them.
Thanks.
Think. Follow the highway code and let's help keep everyone safe. The highway code rules in Northern Ireland may vary.
Cross Question with Ian Dale on LBC.
It is 8:46 on LBC. Khaled is in Leicester. Khaled, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi. Now that Israel is continuously killing innocent men, women, children on a daily basis, without any accountability whatsoever, not listening to anybody, children. The stories are absolutely heart wrenching. You know about the medic.
What's the question, Khaled?
So the question is: now, isn't it about time that we actually imposed sanctions on Israel?
Well, 828 British-based or qualified legal experts have signed a letter to the Prime Minister calling on the government to use all available means to end the war in Gaza, including imposing sanctions and travel bans on ministers in the Israeli government, along with suspending existing trade agreements with Tel Aviv. The week before last, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy suspended talks with Israel about a full trade deal with the UK. David.
I'm actually have a difficulty here, and the difficulty I have is, because I do a programme for the BBC, if I get into this one in a kind of big way, I'm going to have a problem, because we make programmes about this. This is the first time I've ever had to say this, but actually I'm not really in a position to to answer this. I'm analytically, what you can say is that the Israeli government clearly, from what Benjamin Netanyahu said last week, attempting, as far as we could see, to suggest to his very far right-wing cabinet colleagues in other parties that he couldn't do what it was that they wanted to do, which was effectively to shove the Palestinians out of Gaza, and that he had to put some aid in, etc. That there is some recognition in the Israeli government of the degree of international disquiet, to say the very least, that there is about the current situation.
Lucy.
I think you were right, Ian, to say you were turning to a very serious subject, because this is a very, very tragic and difficult subject. And what's happening in Gaza is extremely tragic, very worrying. And it is really important that they get humanitarian aid in and that innocent people aren't being killed. Of course, there is a bigger picture. You know, this began on October the 7th. There are hostages that are still being taken that haven't been returned. And I think the difficulty is that Hamas is demanding an international guarantee that they remain in power. And I would love to see a solution to this issue where there is a two-state solution. And I'm really struggling to see how this comes to an end.
So, but to answer Carly's question on sanctions...
As you rightly said, the British government has taken some steps, and I do think that there is now more international pressure on Israel. I do think that's right, but you know, I'm not in those talks, so I can't say what those steps or any further steps should be.
Ollie.
Would the sanctions be effective? And I pose that question because... From what it seems to me, certainly Benjamin Netanyahu, Itamar Ben-Gvir, Bezalel Smotrich, and some, you know, the far right people that David mentioned, do they care about the condemnation from the international community? Is it an effective mechanism for forcing them to change track? Because actually, I think it was Ben-Gvir who said over the weekend that actually part of the reason they were allowing one plate of food and a piece of pita into Gaza was essentially so that they could continue prosecuting the war, because that was what the international community was requiring of them. So, would it work? Possibly. I'm not sure. Look, I read in the FT this week, and I think it was Ehud Barak, the former Prime Minister of Israel, who was condemning the actions of the government in stronger terms than Keir Starmer has managed to do so thus far. I certainly don't think the British government is going to adopt a position anything like imposing sanctions on the Israeli government. You know, various international organisations, whether it's the ICC or otherwise, are trying to sort of force Israel's hand. But I'm not sure that, you know, the UK sort of withdrawing from this process and saying, yeah, we'll impose sanctions on Israel is necessarily going to change anything.
What did you think of what David Lammy said last week or the week before? Because I thought that... It was one of those things where it all came out at once.
Yeah.
He was very emotional. And I thought, well, whatever the right and wrongs of what he said are, by making that speech in the way that he did in the House of Commons meant that any influence that we might have had on the Israeli government, that was gone for good.
Mm.
Now, it's questionable about how much influence we had anyway, so maybe it didn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, certainly from a security and intelligence perspective, there's a huge amount of cooperation right between the British government and the Israeli government and the Americans. And I think there is a distinction between domestic politics and what gets said in the House of Commons and that degree of cooperation between our various security forces. I would say I was actually quite struck by that Lammy speech. It reminded me, actually, when he was a Labour backbencher during the Windrush scandal. And there's a line that's stuck with me for a long time. He's castigating the Tory minister, and he said, "When you lie down with dogs, you get fleas." And it stayed with me ever since then. I thought, oh, that's Lammy the orator, and orator maybe is the correct way of saying that word. And maybe I'm not one of them. And I've actually thought it was probably the first time as Foreign Secretary that more erudite, that more punchy David Lammy came to the fore, because it was certainly a departure from the public proclamations that him and the other members of the British government have made about Israel so far.
Emma?
It's best I can tell, if the UK was invaded by a bunch of terrorists who killed babies and dogs, we'd also react that way. It looks to me like the hostages need to be freed. And when the hostages are freed, Israel would back down. The other thing is I heard what your caller was saying, but currently you have Hamas, who want to decimate the West and decimate all Jews, who are exploiting Palestinians. So I hope for the sake of Palestinians and for Israel that Hamas are decimated and removed. I hope the hostages come home. I'm sure everybody would like to see peace.
But sanctions, no.
I don't understand where sanctions are relevant. I think the most important point here is a country was invaded, people were taken hostage in the most disgusting circumstances, and we've seen how they have come back, those who are lucky to be alive, and they are emaciated and they've been underground, having not eaten. Red Cross haven't been there. So from a humanitarian and from a personal perspective, I'm most interested in seeing the hostages freed and Hamas decimated.
I was watching the BBC News last night and seeing pictures of these emaciated Palestinian children as well. And it was almost like on a loop. And I don't doubt that these children have experienced terrible times. But we have to remember that there are humanitarian concerns on both sides of that.
100%.
Fence here, don't
Look,
we?
It's absolutely terrible. But equally, I just don't trust a terrorist organisation to distribute any supplies that are coming into Gaza. So we're not dealing with two fair governments here.
I think we should be clear: Hamas has never been distributing the aid inside Gaza. Now there are some
They've
arguments.
Keeping it for themselves.
Hold on. I'm not going to have a shouting match about this or a sort of kind of, you know, tribal, get into a kind of tribal position about this. The agencies responsible for doing the distribution of aid are not Hamas. Now, what you're talking about is whether Hamas then interdicts part of that aid once it's been delivered by those agencies. That's what I was trying to say. And we do not have a significant alternative to those agencies doing that distribution. That's simply a fact. Now, what the Israeli government has said is, we want to take that over and give it to private companies. That is not a trustworthy mechanism for doing it. And this is one of the really significant problems we've got. And there does become, let's look at it from the point of view that I mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu's own perception that the level of pressure, because of the seeing children dying of famine in Gaza, is unacceptable to the international community. That was his view. He said it, not me. And I think that is what they're dealing with at the moment. Well, the other thing I would just say is the thing that would change whether or not I think governments in Europe and Britain would impose sanctions would be a determination by the Israeli government to do what those two Israeli ministers keep on talking about, which is the forced removal of the Palestinian population from Gaza. I think that would materially alter people's attitude to what policy they took.
I'm going to add one little thing, if I may. And I mean, I'm not aiming to be tribal or shouting. I'm not sure what either of those were about. But I do think it's unusual when you're asking two people at war for one of them to provide aid to the other. And I don't agree with you that aid is not getting in, because I'm reading the international news. I don't know if we're reading something different. I do know that I trust Israel more than I trust Hamas, and I trust Israel more than I trust UNRWA.
But it isn't getting in. That's the point. They've had 9,000 lorries waiting on the border, and they're not being allowed in. Now, over the last 24 hours, apparently there has been some aid allowed in.
How much? Sounds like good news for everybody.
Well, I don't know how much that would be of those 9,000. Right, let's go to a question from Gareth in Wilmslow in Cheshire. With the fastest growing economy in the G7, do critics of Rachel Reeves now owe her an apology? The IMF has raised its prediction of Britain's economic growth for this year to 1.2%, with a 1.4% growth expected next year. The IMF had previously forecasted only 1.1% growth for this year. You touched on this earlier, Ollie.
I did, and no, I don't owe Rachel Reeves an apology. The question about delivery and deliverism, I guess, in relation to Joe Biden is probably the most recent example. And for all of the growth, for all of the praise of the IMF, for all of PwC saying that the UK is a great place to invest, unless people see an explosion in their real terms wages, it will not count a penny when we come to the 2029 general election and Nigel Farage is knocking on the door. If Rachel Reeves does not do something, and I would say, as I think people have probably gathered, a departure from fiscal conservatism, I think she and Keir Starmer will be remembered as the handmaidens to a reform government.
Right. Admirably concise. If you can all be concise, I'd be grateful because we are reaching the end of the programme. Emma?
At 1.1 versus 1.2 to 1.4% is glacial, as far as I'm concerned. I live in a world where if that's what's being achieved, that's against headwinds of the government not helping to create growth for business. So that feels like that doesn't feel very impressive to me at all. And I definitely don't owe Rachel Reeves an apology. And I don't...
It's more than the rest of the G7. I mean, that has to count for something.
Well, I've got to be honest with you. It sounds like everybody else isn't doing terribly well and we're doing all right, which doesn't really work for me.
Lucy?
The IMF changes its predictions on growth from time to time, often nothing to do with what the UK or any domestic government is doing. It's based on international issues and other issues, for example, the cost of our energy here and how we've sourced it over a long period of time. And I agree 100% with Ollie. It doesn't really matter what you say the rate of inflation is, what the IMF's growth figures are. What matters to the British people is what can they afford, what is the provision of public services and how do they feel. And these statistics, we rely on them the whole time as politicians, but they're pretty meaningless to most people.
David?
The statistics may be meaningless, but they do mean something in the long term. The government's need is to try and get some growth into the economy. That's the trajectory that it's got to prove it's on by, it's got another 3 years, roughly, in order to do it. It's a very, very tricky thing. For various reasons, I don't think it'll be a handmaiden to a reform government, by the way, but that's a completely different issue. You don't win with 30%, 25 to 30% of the vote.
Right, our fun question is from Gordon in Hampstead. It remains unclear whether Brigitte Macron's hands on her husband's face at the weekend was just goofing around, as they claim. Well, not the French is for goofing around. When have the panel been forced to find an excuse for something embarrassing that they've been caught doing? Who would like to go first on that? Ollie?
It's probably, Having told work that, you know, the boiler's gone and I've got to work from home and you know.
You're the boss, aren't you?
Well, yeah, but I still answer to some people, Ian, and which makes it worse because then when you're on a Zoom call with them and it's very clear that, in fact, the heating in your home isn't broken because you're wearing a T-shirt and it's December, let's just say I got found out.
And that's the most embarrassing thing.
It's absolutely not the most embarrassing thing, but I've reserved quite a lot of it for not being broadcast on this radio station.
Okay, tell us afterwards. Emma?
I literally am going through a catalogue of inappropriate things that I can't share, and the carousel has yet to take me to any...